A new study looks at how long Wisconsinites are living and how healthy we are. And the short answer here is that we are living longer, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're in better health.
Joining us now to discuss the new report is Karen Timberlake. She's director of the UW Population Health Institute, which produced the Wisconsin Health Trends Progress Report. Karen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things you measured in the Wisconsin Health Trends Progress Report is how long we're living in Wisconsin. So what's that overall big picture trend looking like?
I would say overall the big picture trend on length of life is that people in Wisconsin are generally living longer. We look at a variety of snapshots of rates of death, and we particularly want to focus on things like premature death rates and certainly deaths of children and very young adults. And what we see there is overall premature death, which we consider any kind of death before age 75, that trend is generally moving in the right direction. Same thing for infants and same thing for people between ages 1 and 24. So overall, those are positive indicators.
We'll dig down into some of the numbers behind that. But another big picture item, that doesn't necessarily mean we're also healthier, even though we're living longer. Why is that?
Exactly. And that's really one of the key takeaways in this report. So for many years now, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, has been asking people all across the country, including in Wisconsin, on average, would you rate your health as excellent, very good, good, fair, or poor? And what we see in Wisconsin is a really troubling trend of adults who are reporting their health as being no better than fair or poor. And on the one hand, you might say, well, you're going to just talk to people on the phone, and maybe they're having a bad day. You know, how do we know that this is really reliable data? It's been checked and double-checked over the years, and people who report their health as only fair or poor are much more likely to experience premature death of the type we were just talking about wanting to avoid. And they also are much more likely to have chronic diseases and otherwise be in bad health. So this turns out to be a pretty reliable and very concerning indicator.
And this, yeah, and more of us are saying we're feeling bad. Do we have any idea why that would be?
You know, getting underneath those numbers would require, obviously, quite a bit of additional work. But what we can see overall from the trends is that certainly rates of many kinds of common chronic diseases are on the rise, so obesity being probably the easiest one to point to in our own data. We also know that people experience a high degree of stress, and that often expresses itself in self-reported fair and poor health. And so what we know is that this tells us that we have more to do to understand why people are not feeling better and what we can do about that.
An interesting thing about this report as a whole is it's a multi-year thing. You're looking at 19, I think it was, different areas, hoping for a 1% improvement. That seems pretty modest from year to year up to the year 2020, I think it was. So how are we doing overall? Are we meeting our goals in Wisconsin to get a little bit healthier each year?
Right. And so I like this report because it's really easy to see at a glance over a 10-year period of time, is the state, in terms of health, headed in the right direction, or are we on the wrong track? You know, if you think about all of the political prognosticating that's going on, this is kind of our right direction, wrong track report for health. And what I would say is it's a mixed picture. So, you know, things like obesity continues to be a challenge in our state. On the bright side, we're actually seeing some positive progress in terms of excessive drinking, which tends to be one of those health risk factors where Wisconsin leads the nation in all the wrong categories. And then by the same token, when you look at some of the things that really influence health that we might not think about, so things like high school graduation and unemployment and child poverty, there we have also some cause for concern.
And this report seems like it could help us really target public health efforts. One thing that struck me, smoking generally going down, good news. But for people, I think it was without high school degrees, smoking rates four times higher than college graduates. So does that help us craft a plan? Like, okay, here's the audience we need to reach with our anti-smoking programs?
Yep, that's really a great point. So two things to highlight there. One is certainly this report is a call to action for people in the public health community, but it's really a call to action for everyone who cares about the health of our population. And that really should be everybody. So So people's health matters to employers, it matters to government programs, it matters to their ability to be good parents and good citizens. So this really is an issue of concern to our whole state. And then just to your point on smoking in particular, we see, you know, really a 2% increase year over year in smoking rates, so heading very much in the wrong direction for people with less than a high school degree. So that's exactly right. It tells us that what we've done to reach college graduates and get them, you know, at smoking at less than 10% on average now, that's a wild success, but we're completely failing in our efforts to reach people who have not completed high school, and that's a, you know, significant number of people in the state, so we need to do better.
Another target area for a number of these issues, urban areas, for some of these measures are doing noticeably worse than the rest of the state.
Right. And what we see, of course, is that sometimes in the more urban parts of the state and also the more rural parts of the state, that can correlate with higher rates of poverty. And one thing we know is that poverty is closely associated with being in worse health status overall. Not 100%, doesn't mean that everyone living in poverty is going to be in bad health. But we do know that on average, we need to do more and do better, not only to address the health concerns of people living in poverty, but to work on poverty itself as that underlying driver of poor health.
Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Karen Timberlake of the UW Population Health Institute about the state of Wisconsinites' health. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. What do you think is driving the trend of residents of our state stopping smoking? Some good news of being less healthy, more obesity on the bad side. Is there a reason we haven't been able to reverse these increasing levels of obesity? What makes being healthy a challenge for you? What do you see in your community that you think could make a big difference when it came to people's health? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Karen Timberlake. She's director of the UW Population Health Institute, which produced the recent Wisconsin Health Trends 2015 Progress Report. Look at why we as a state are not as healthy as we could be, despite the fact that overall we're living a little longer. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Tim on the line in Menominee. Tim, hi.
Hi. A little bit about me. I'm a 31-year-old heart attack survivor. And something that I heard in the office a while back made me perk up and pay attention. It's that since low fat has become more popular, which increased the sugar in our diet, the incidence of heart attack has actually gone up. But we haven't noticed it as much because doctors have gotten better at fixing people's heart attacks. I'm wondering if there's any data in that might ferret that out.
Tim, thanks for the call. Always happy to help people ferret things out. But Karen, I don't know if you want to get into the low-fat diet and heart attacks thing. You're welcome to. But also, is part of our longer lifespan about better medical care, better medical technology, and maybe access to medical care?
Right. I think Tim makes an excellent point, and certainly we're glad to hear that he's a survivor of a very scary event, mm-hmm. I'm sure. So he makes an excellent point that we've made incredible medical advances in this country and really in the world. And, you know, think about what was possible just 100 years ago for people as compared to what's possible today. So again, we can keep people alive. The question is, how do they feel and what kind of disease burden are they living with? Because part of what we know from our work here at the Population Health Institute is if you look overall at how long people are living and how healthy they would say they are, the research suggests that at best, access to health care and the kind of health care you get influences about 20% of those results. And everything else, your health choices, the health behaviors, your education level, your income level, the physical environment you're living in, clean air, clean water, all of those things make up 80% of how long and how well we live. So on the one hand, that might seem, you know, sort of intuitive to people. On the other hand, you know, we spend a lot of time and energy thinking about health and going right to a conversation about health care when really it's all those other things in our lives and our neighborhoods and our communities and our workplaces that are really driving how healthy we are.
Tim, thanks for your call, and good luck to you. And Karen, you mentioned poverty, you mentioned some of these social and economic factors, and you actually rated some of those. You rate those each year in this annual report. What are some of the areas that that this report focuses on?
Yep, we really do want to focus on what we call those social and economic factors, because, again, the literature tells us that that's about 40% of what determines how long and how well people live. So we look at things like the rate of high school dropout, we look at unemployment, we look at child poverty, we look at the violent crime rate, because obviously people who don't feel safe in their neighborhoods are not going to feel inclined to go out and take a walk. And what you can see if you look closely at the data is, of course, a lot of these numbers do bounce around quite a lot over the last decade. On balance, though, if you take sort of the best fit look at the numbers, the trends are all heading in the wrong direction. So we have increasing high school dropouts, increasing unemployment at over a decade, although the last couple of years it looks better, and overall increasing child poverty, which is of particular concern. Children live in families, so that means we have a lot of families in our state living in poverty, and that percentage continues to grow.
So all those things have a negative health impact that you just mentioned, but they're really kind of out of the hands of, you know, healthcare providers, the public health community, the individuals themselves. So who needs to be at the table? Who needs to be part of a collaboration to tackle those as public health issues?
Well, it's interesting. So you might say they're out of the hands of any one of those groups of people individually, right? So what can a health system do about high school graduation rates? By itself, nothing. But what we're seeing around the state and around the country is at a community level, all of those groups you mentioned, so healthcare, public health, business leaders, local government, individuals themselves, are coming together to say, hey, in our community, we want more kids graduating from high school. Or in our community, we want more five-year-olds entering kindergarten ready to learn. What can we all do? And while no one person, no one organization holds the silver bullet solution, there actually are things that each of those sectors acting in a coordinated way together can do to move the needle. And that's really some of the exciting work in health improvement.
And are you hoping that this annual report you do will inspire people at the state level and in these local communities to do these kind of collaborations?
Absolutely. We think it's really important to keep track of our progress. You know, it's one thing to look at a snapshot of data, but, you know, one data point is one data point, and it doesn't really help you sort of widen the lens out and step back and say, all right, overall, maybe we had a bad year, but overall, how are we doing on something like obesity or smoking or high school graduation? And when we see a trend that's positive, even if we have a bad year, we can say, well, you know, in general, we should keep doing what we're doing. But where we see these trends that are negative, that really should cause all leaders in whatever sector in our state to ask themselves what they can be doing differently, because continuing to do what we're doing is going to get us more of the same result.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for your interest.
That's Karen Timberlake, director of the UW Population Health Institute. They produced the new Wisconsin Health Trends 2015 Progress Report. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Wisconsin has the highest rate of drunken driving in the country. According to the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, alcohol-related crashes killed 223 people in the state and injured almost 3,000 in the year 2012. In that same year, approximately 36% of all fatal traffic accidents in the state were alcohol-related.
One option for courts in these cases, repeat drunken drivers can be required to install an ignition interlock device. It requires the driver to blow into a tube to start a vehicle, something like a breathalyzer. If the driver has a blood alcohol content greater than the pre-programmed level, the vehicle won't start. Most models also require random retests as the vehicle's being driven.
But a new investigation into ignition interlock devices, known as IIDs, shows that only 56% of those required by the courts are being installed in Wisconsin. Adam Schrager is with us now to talk about his investigation. He's an investigative reporter for WISC-TV. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what kind of information were you looking for in this investigation into ignition interlock devices?
So this all started for me, as any, I'm sure you know this too, Veronica, you get emails from law enforcement agencies all the time, and they come kind of routinely every night, every morning, and I had noticed when people would pull over repeat drunk drivers, so people with second, third, fourth, fifth, and on OWIs, there was a little line in there that would talk about how they had been cited also for not having an ignition interlock device or an IID. And I started asking about what this was about. I knew these kind of sobriety machines where you have to blow to, in order to actually start the car. And I was wondering, you know, I mean, it's one of the most effective tools to stopping drunk driving, with the exception of not drinking and getting behind the wheel in the first place. And why weren't these being used?
And so you wanted to find out, you know, what was going on with the reason why IIDs, ignition interlock devices, were not being used. So how did you get at that question? How did you gather your information?
I asked the Department of Transportation, and they provided data. They don't have clear data from 2011, but they have data from 2012 forward. And so what I was able to get from them was the number of times a court had issued an order for a vehicle to be outfitted with an IID, and then the number of times that they actually had been outfitted with an IID.
Well, let's get to that result. What did you find?
So we found that in that time frame, judges had ordered 54,329 to be installed on convicted offenders' vehicles, and 30,756, or roughly 56%, had been installed. So you're looking at roughly half have not.
Right, that's a big disconnect. So I guess the question is, why are almost half of these devices not being installed when it's been ordered by a court?
No one's checking. It's about as simple an answer as I can give you. A court issues this order, and then it just sits there on a driver's abstract. And it's important to point out, too, a lot of these folks have had their licenses suspended as well. So they're driving with suspended licenses in addition to not having an ignition interlock device on their car. And we don't hear about these people unless and until there's another incident where they're either arrested or they've gotten into an accident. So these people are potentially on the roads every single day in the state of Wisconsin.
So once a court orders a person to get an IID, what is the process then of installing the IID?
So there are a number of companies that provide this service, that contract with the State Department of Transportation to provide this service to offenders. They're located all over the state. And an offender literally has to take their car in. It takes a couple of hours to hook this device up to their car, and then every 60 days or so they have to come back in. So the data from that device is uploaded into a computer, which is then sent to the court. So it's very labor-intensive. There's a cost associated with it as well. But judges are issuing these sentences. Clearly, the state has sent a message from the legislature to the governor to the judges themselves now that they want these devices installed. They want this as a way to prevent drunk driving in the state of Wisconsin. It's just not happening.
So presumably no one's saying, look, you can't have your car back until this is installed.
Correct. No one is saying that. And frankly, I mean, we spoke with a Beloit police sergeant who's done traffic for 27 years, and he said the analogy he gave was, look, if you're sentenced to parole, you have to speak with your parole officer. If you're sentenced to jail, you have to go to jail. If you're sentenced to prison, you have to go to prison. And if you don't, there's a warrant issued for your arrest, and they get you, and then they put you in prison. And yet, when you're issued an order to get an IID, who checks? No one.
Is it supposed to be anyone's job and it's just not enforced, or is there literally no mechanism for checking in place?
There's literally no mechanism. I mean, if you think about it, it would cost a significant amount of money. There's a resource issue at stake here as well, where somebody would physically have to check. And there are a number of ways to do this. And this is a problem it's important to mention that's not unique to Wisconsin. This is happening all over the country. Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which is arguably one of the biggest proponents of IIDs across the country, says that states that do particularly well with this are still only looking at 60 to 65% participation. So it's just from a resource standpoint, you can certainly ask the question, what is government going to do? What could they do? Are the resources there to literally watch over these people who have been sentenced to install these in their cars?
What are the consequences if you're someone who's supposed to have an ignition interlock device in your car and you don't and you get pulled over?
And that's really, it's a citation. It's a traffic citation. And that's what Senator Van Wongard at the Capitol had been trying to basically bulk that up and say you're going to have to face more serious fines. Potentially, if you're a repeat offender at this, you could go to jail for this. That bill passed out of a Senate committee. It's before the full Senate right now, but the State Assembly is adjourned for the year, so that measure doesn't look like it's going anywhere for the rest of the year.
We're talking with Adam Schrager right now. He's an investigative reporter for WISC-TV, talking about his investigation into the use of ignition interlock devices, how often they're actually being installed when they are ordered by a court. The answer, not very often, roughly half the time. And you mentioned MAD being a big proponent of IIDs, and that the states that have the best luck with this also do the most enforcing. What kind of enforcing do they do?
Well, they're basically one of the things that MAD had pushed in other states nationwide was this idea of, instead of waiting for the court to actually issue this sentence, if you had somebody who had been arrested for an OWI, they could voluntarily take the IID immediately and not wait for the sentence, which, as we all know, the court system sometimes can take a long time. So maybe you're waiting 6 months, maybe you're waiting a year, maybe you have your license suspended, and then you're after that 6 month waiting period, so then you're waiting a year and a half before you're supposed to install this ignition interlock device. They've had success in states where they've actually sped up the process. So an offender can basically self-punish, if you will, and request to put this IID on their car or on their whatever vehicle they're driving sooner rather than later, and that has increased its usage nationwide.
How accepted are IIDs in Wisconsin? Do they have is there anyone out there who's against the use of these things?
No, interestingly enough, certainly the offenders who have to use them will talk about they're unwieldy, they can cost a certain amount of money at times. Basically, they can stop a car from running at 0.02 blood alcohol content. So you're looking at potentially, if you've used hand sanitizer, it could potentially set this thing off. So people will talk about, at times, the unwieldy nature of them. And yet, they continue to be issued as sentences by judges across the state. So clearly, there's a sign from the judicial system taking the direction of the legislative system to go ahead and use these as sentences for offenders.
Now, for your investigation, you talked to a police sergeant from Beloit. What did he have to say?
He was talking about how they're seeing, interestingly enough right now, fewer first-time offenders but more repeat offenders, which would lead one to wonder. And at the end of the day, too, you have to ask yourself, if somebody's a repeat offender, stopping them from drinking and driving is an important component, obviously, but at the same point, you want to get to the medical issue of why somebody continues to do this. And yet there's not much of an oversight. And he was saying the frustrating thing for them is, you know, you'll pull somebody over. They just recently in Beloit pulled somebody over on an alleged 10th OWI, and their officers are shaking their heads saying, why is this person behind the wheel in the first place?
And did he give you any indication about what kind of legislation police departments might like to see?
I think they would certainly like to see fewer drunk drivers on the roads in Wisconsin. It's an accident in many cases just waiting to happen. Uniformly, you'll see officers around the state will set up patrols and get grant money in an effort to get drunk drivers off the roads. But they're beholden to the laws of the land. And right now, they can be sentenced to, you're not allowed to drive. They could suspend an offender's license. They could require an IID to be installed. And yet no one's checking on either of those two things to make sure that somebody's not getting behind the wheel.
Now, you mentioned that other states have this in place, some more successfully than others. How does Wisconsin measure up in terms of that statistic of installation rates?
It's kind of in the middle of the pack. As I mentioned, even the best states are not looking at anything more than 65 or so percent installation. Because the idea, it's a very Big Brother type of enforcement were people to go down this road. And Senator Weingart at the Capitol had actually proposed legislation also to transfer. Right now, the sentence goes to any vehicle that an offender might own. So if you are an offender and you have two cars registered in your name, you are required to have an IID on each of those cars. Offenders have been getting around that by simply driving other people's cars. So what the legislation he had also proposed at the state capitol was to shift that responsibility from the vehicle to the individual's driver's license. So no matter what vehicle they would get behind the wheel of, if they were a convicted offender who had been sentenced to receive an IID, they could not drive any car, any vehicle, without this IID, whether it was registered in their name or not.
And that proposal from Wanger made it out of committee, it sounds like, and then died in the Assembly. Do you have any sense of what the future for that bill might be?
Well, it didn't necessarily die in the Assembly. It's just stuck.
It didn't
right
get taken up.
In legislative
right.
purgatory, if you will. It's standing before the full state Senate, where Senator Wanger expects it to pass. But since the state assembly is not committed to coming back for the rest of the year, that too will just kind of sit there.
Is he optimistic about prospects for it in the future?
I think everybody, you'd probably have to ask him for his true assessment of where that legislation stands. I think everybody involved in the process, you're seeing legislation right now before the governor to make more repeat drunk driving offenses, a fourth-time offense, a felony, and increase some of the fines. It seems like there's sentiment at the Capitol to increase penalties for repeat offenders. Whether this is rolled into that in the future, we'll have to see.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica. I appreciate your time.
That was Adam Schrager, investigative reporter for WISC-TV. He joined us to talk about his investigation into ignition interlock devices in Wisconsin.